of science and multiple partnerships with scientists, institutions, stakeholders, museums to examine the social history, philosophy of science. And this project has been going for 8 years, doing all kinds of stuff that you've seen around Halifax and across the country. If you want to see some of the activities, including our last lecture series called Lives of Evidence, check out the websites, including science at cityside.ca. And there's a whole mess of videos and papers and conference proceedings, all of which are extremely interesting. We're filming tonight's lecture, and it will be uploaded to last. It's not live streamed like most of our lectures, but this one will be archived on the Situated Science website. We are working in collaboration this evening with the Center for Comparative Genomics and Evolutionary Bioinformatics on bringing Ron numbers up from America to talk about creation science and its important origins in the Maritimes. Ron numbers has origins in the Maritimes. He's from New Brunswick, and he might tell us a bit about that in his lecture. If not, I'll ask him in the question period. He is one of the premier historians of science in the world. And if you've done any work on the relationship between science and religion, or even in the general history of science, you'll have seen Ron Numbers, who is Mr. Izzy. He had his PhD way back when at the University of California in Berkeley, and then after a very short period where he was fired from MoMA, Linda University, is that right? He took up a very long-term important position at the University of Wisconsin at Madison as a resident historian of science and medicine, and eventually became the Hilldale and William Coleman professor in the history of science and medicine until he just retired this year.
Last year,
to get out of committee work, he tells me. Great idea. Those that are working in history of science know him as the indefatigable editor of the premier journal in history of science, the unfortunately named nowadays ISIS. Or maybe it's appropriate for your work, I don't know. But his other works are Legion. He's worked on with some of my colleagues on Galileo Goes to Jail and Other Myths About Science, Science and Christianity in Pulpit and Pew. Where did Science and Christianity Meet? These are just his books. I'm not talking about bazillion articles. Darwinism Comes to America, God and Nature, and his classic, which is a big, fat tome and poor little magic copy that people pick up. He doesn't have one. You will all buy a copy because the bookstore outside is selling Ron Numbers books, and I hope you will buy some and you will stick around.
They offering a steep discount?
No.
Oh. I wouldn't buy it then.
Do not buy on Amazon, by the way. I hope you have looked up their various business practices. Buy it from the Co-op Store of Teams, which is outside. And if we get Ron liquored up, we'll sign everyone and his author's pockets. His magnum opus is the creation of the text that was published in 1993. Is that right? And then reissued in 2006 as the definitive history of creationism. Without further ado, Ron Numbers.
I guess I don't need. Thank you very much, Gordon. And thank you, Ford Doolittle, for arranging for my stop over here. We met by accident in Iowa City last winter and struck up a conversation, and he said, well, why don't you stop by here the next time you're on the east coast of Canada? As Gordon mentioned, I have deep roots in the Maritimes. I began school in Moncton, New Brunswick. I lasted for a year before my family moved down to the West Indies. My father was a fundamentalist minister and failed in trying to convert the people of the Maritimes to his particular sect. Much better success in the West Indies. So it's really delightful for me to be back, in a sense, home, and to tell you about a person who is arguably the most influential person to come out of the Maritimes ever. But he's not celebrated. I think there are no monuments to him in the Maritimes, and probably most people have never heard of him. His name is George McCready Price, and he has millions of followers around the world today. So that's the story I'm going to focus on this evening. The man who was the chief, I was going to say creator, but that wouldn't be good, the chief architect. Oh, thank you very much. The chief architect of what has come to be known as creation science or scientific creationism. George Price was born in 1870 in rural New Brunswick, and except for the loss of his father when he was a child, he seems to have had a fairly uneventful childhood. But then when he was in his early teens, his mother converted to a strange sect called the Seventh-day Adventist. And that had a huge influence, a determining influence on Price's later life and work. Now, the Seventh-day Adventists, I don't know if there's anybody here who knows anything about Seventh-day Adventists. They're often confused with Jehovah's Witnesses or Mormons or something else. But they were created in the middle of the 19th century by a young woman prophetess named Ellen G. White, who at the age of 17 began going into trances and experiencing visions. And then these visions, her guiding angel, unfortunately never gave it a name, but she became familiar with it, used to take her and show her events past, present, and future. And on one occasion when young Ellen White was concerned about the correct interpretation of the first chapters of Genesis in the Bible, she was taken by her angel guide to witness the actual creation and was shown that it had occurred in 6 literal days of 24 hours each, and that in another vision that much of the face of the earth had been restructured during and shortly after Noah's flood. So by virtue of becoming a Seventh-day Adventist as a teenager, young Price was committed to this particular interpretation, was very much a minority interpretation among even evangelical Christians during the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Price never obtained a significant scientific education. As a young man, he went away to college in Battle Creek, Michigan, to a school established by John Harvey Kellogg, better known as the inventor of flake cereals and peanut butter. And he himself didn't make a lot of money of this, but his brother did. So much money that he had enough left over to fund the library and the medical school, which I see as W.K. Kellogg Memorial Library. So if you like the library, you should eat a lot of flake cereal to thank him for that. But when he was at Battle Creek College, Price, who intended to be some kind of writer, took the classics course rather than any science courses, and then returned to the Maritimes. He had a hard time finding himself. He thought he might be a preacher, but he had a squeaky, high-pitched voice that didn't go over well. He tried to be a teacher. He wasn't very successful at that. He had his best luck selling religious books door-to-door in Prince Edward Island, where he rode a bike over the rough roads. He also, I'm not sure what promoted this, but as a young man, he married a woman 12 years his senior and had a couple of children that he seems not to have had much of a connection with throughout his latter part of his life. The turn of the century found Price teaching at a remote school in New Brunswick, located in, I hope I pronounced this correctly, Tracadie, New Brunswick. So remote that the Canadian government, in its wisdom, had put the leprosarium there, so nobody else would catch leprosy. And about the only other educated person in that small community was the physician, Harvard-educated physician, who was the superintendent. And so the two people, Price, the school teacher, and the doctor in the leprosarium, struck up a friendship. The doctor was shocked to discover that the school teacher didn't believe in evolution. So being an employee of the Canadian government and being able to receive Canadian publications free, he started lending Price the reports of the Canadian Geological Survey. Price might not have been very polished, but he was bright and a voracious reader. He consumed these documents and almost became an evolutionist. In one of the few autobiographical accounts of a struggle with the claims of evolution versus biblical Christianity, he tells in detail how on three separate occasions he almost succumbed to the lures of evolution, but by reading the inspired words of Ellen White and engaging in intense sessions of prayer, he was able to resist. And he decided that he would devote the rest of his very long life, he lived into the 1960s, responding to the claims of evolution and historical geology. In reading these government documents, he ran across two phenomena that he thought were just wrong. That geologists, in order to save their theory of long geological ages, hundreds of millions of years, had invented two cockamamie explanations that were confounded by common sense. One was something called overthrusts or thrust faults. And Canada and parts of America were notable for one of the big ones in the world called the Lewis overthrust, covering thousands of square miles in Alberta and Montana. And you have a phenomenon there where there had been a fracture in the surface of the earth at some remote time in antiquity, and then a huge swath of the landscape had come sliding over another part. And over millennia, much of it had eroded, leaving fairly old rock on top of fairly young rock. I said, this is absurd. Just to save their theory, the geologists are telling us that this major tectonic activity took place when anybody with common sense could see that this had happened naturally. And the iconic image from this area is not a tall mountain in Glacier National Park called Chief Mountain. Some of you may have visited in that part. And you have this mountain formed of ancient rock sitting on much younger rock. He said, why don't we just accept that this was deposited in that order during the time of Noah's flood? Less dramatic, but probably equally convincing for him, was the phenomenon of deceptive conformities. I won't tell you any more about science after this, but deceptive conformities are where you have the strata lying conformably, that is, as if they had been deposited directly on the lower rock. But geologists said, well, no, huge amount of time elapsed because the rock on top is much younger. So there had to have been a lapse of time before the younger rocks were deposited. And again, Price appealed to common sense and said, look, if they look conformable, even to the geologists, they must be conformable. They must have been deposited in quick succession. His conclusion from all this was that the geological column, so carefully constructed by geologists and paleontologists in the early 19th century, was nothing but a figment of the geologist's imagination. And that, in fact, the fossil record, the geological column, was topsy-turvy. That in different places around the world, you would find so-called older rocks above younger rocks and other phenomena that had convinced him that there was no regularity to the fossil record. He wrote a book while he was still in Tracadie announcing his conclusions in a somewhat rough and timid way that would not characterize his later writings. He got a Seventh-day Adventist publisher to bring it out in 1902. It did not bring him either fame or wealth. In fact, he couldn't find employment. So he decided that he would take off to New York City and write for the hack papers, as he called them, in this metropolis. He gets down there and he can't find work in New York City. His wife and children are back up in the Maritimes. He became deeply depressed. I believe quit attending church and gave up his belief in divine providence for a period, and had decided to sell his watch and buy a gun and rid the world of another worthless human being, as he phrased it in a letter. Needless to say, when his wife heard about his dire straits, she panicked. She wrote the headquarters of the church in the outskirts of Washington, D.C., and begged them to find some kind of employment for her husband. And it worked. And they invited him down to Tacoma Park, Maryland, to help build church headquarters, which were just moving from Michigan to the District of Columbia. So here was this author, published author, doing manual labor, construction at church headquarters, getting absolutely no respect at all. A few years later, he moved out to Southern California, where the Adventists were building a sanitarium at Loma Linda, a place I'm very fond of because they fired me many decades later, as was mentioned. There, he was a handyman and was again employed doing manual labor, but he kept working on his critique of geology. And in 1906, he self-published what was a long pamphlet called Illogical Geology, in which he laid down as a geological law his conclusion that the fossils could be found in any order whatsoever. And even though he was desperately poor, he offered $1,000 to anybody who could disprove his claim. There was not a chance in the world anybody was going to get that $1,000. He sent out hundreds of copies to prominent scientists. Some of them actually engaged him in debate before giving up in frustration, realizing that reasoning was not going to make any difference in Price's views. He remained an obscure figure until about 1917. He published a few books in the interval, when Fleming Ravel, an evangelical publisher, Ravel happened to be Dwight L. Moody's brother-in-law and was a big-time evangelical publisher. And he published one of Price's books called QED, and that brought Price to the attention of the broader evangelical community just on the eve of the anti-evolution controversy that broke out in the early 1920s in America. Excuse me. I think that's straight from an iceberg. Within a very short period of time, Price was publishing in a number of religious journals, Presbyterian, Catholic, Methodist, whatever, and many in Seventh-day Adventist journals, promoting his ideas, undermining evolution. In fact, he became so prominent that in the mid-1920s, the journal Science, published by the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the most prestigious journal in the United States, declared him to be the principal scientific authority of the fundamentalists. And indeed, he had become that. Virtually every anti-evolutionist writer of the 1920s cited Price as an authority, a scientific authority, against evolution. Not surprisingly, not a single one adopted his interpretation of Genesis. And I think that's partly, at least, because of his sectarian slash cultist background. And here, let me just give you a brief background of conservative Christians and geology. To make a very long story short, geologists constructed their column, their famous column that appears in every textbook down to the present, during the period from about 1810 to 1840. Most of them who were engaged in this were Christians, and several of the most prominent ones were actually Christian clergymen. They were not doing this, as critics would later claim, to undermine the Bible, but to help understand the Bible. And the Christians, by and large, readily accepted the evidence from geology and paleontology and interpreted in one of two ways. One was to say that the days of Genesis were actually ages. And there was biblical warrant for this. The Bible says that a day in the eyes of the Lord is 1,000 years. So making this judgment didn't seem to be outrageous in terms of orthodox biblical scholarship. And so if each day of Genesis represented millions of years, not a big problem. As long as the story of the creation of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden came at the end of those hundreds of millions of years. So humans continued to be young. Another very popular interpretation, perhaps even more popular, was something that came to be known as the gap theory. Now, I'm sure everybody here is familiar with the Bible, but I'll remind you a little bit of it. The beginning of Genesis says, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." The author, probably Moses, never said when the beginning was. So perhaps you could put the beginning at the very beginning. And then the author in the third and fourth verses comes to the Edenic creation associated with Adam and Eve. So given what geologists had found, these biblical exegetes inserted the entire geological column between the beginning and the Garden of Eden. And in that gap, the gap that Moses doesn't mention, you could have as many creations and catastrophes and recreations as you needed to account for the fossil record. In 1909, Oxford University Press published an annotated version of the King James Bible called the Scofield Reference Bible. Some of you may have seen that. And Mr. Scofield was very helpful in one of the notes The advantage of the reference Bible was that it had explanatory notes with it, put down there that Moses was really endorsing the gap theory. That was what God was revealing. And so it took on scriptural authority for many people. Fundamentalists and Pentecostals especially embraced the Scofield Reference Bible. And Oxford estimates that they probably sold about 10 million copies. Now, if you take a look at the early Scofield Reference Bible, you'll see in the middle margin the date 4004 BC. So some people say, oh, well, no, you know, it shows that creation took place in 4004 BC. But if you read carefully, that is the date assigned for the Edenic restoration, not for the beginning, which is undated. So you still get this to retain that iconic date from Usher, Bishop Usher, in the reading, but at the same time absorb all of the evidence that the geologists were turning up. As I've alluded to, in the early 1920s, for the first time, organized anti-evolutionism broke out. There had been potshots throughout the latter part of the 19th and early 20th centuries, but nobody had taken the trouble to organize opposition. But in the years since 1859, the publication of The Origin of Species, many churches and schools had adopted evolution. And it was the success of evolution, of the teaching and preaching of evolution, that prompted conservative Christians to fight back. And they did so with enthusiasm. They began organizing anti-evolution societies. They began introducing laws into state legislatures. And in three states passed laws making it illegal to teach human evolution. One of those states, the first of the states to pass one of those laws, was Tennessee in early 1925. And the fledgling American Civil Liberties Union in New York City noticed in a newspaper that this had happened down in Tennessee and decided that they would oppose it. They had only been in existence a short time, but they thought this would be a great case to take on. And so they put notices in the Chattanooga and Memphis Nashville papers looking for a guinea pig who would offer himself up as the sacrificial lamb in this case. You all know about the Scopes trial in the summer of 1925, in which a young high school science teacher, however, not a biology teacher, was, quote, arrested for teaching human evolution. And a great film was released in 1959 and 1960 called Inherit the Wind. It's a marvelous film. It's pathetic history. But I still like to show it to my classes, and then I spend an hour or two correcting everything that's wrong in the movie. Scopes was never arrested. He volunteered. He was never put in jail, as the film depicts. And worst of all, He was never in love with the preacher's daughter. I mean, that's the whole heart of the movie, falling in love with the preacher's daughter. The preacher who was denouncing him to hell in this. And in one of the critical scenes that has stuck with just about everybody who's seen it, and unfortunately with historians who should know better, you have the agnostic defense attorney, Clarence Darrow from Chicago, facing off against William Jennings Bryan, a leader of the fundamentalist movement, and one of the most popular politicians in America, who had run three times as the Democratic nominee for president, and was a fantastic orator. And Darrow, in what seems to be an unprecedented move, called Bryan to the stand as an authority on the Bible. Now, you don't get to call your opposing attorney as an expert witness. But Bryan was so confident of his biblical knowledge that he told his other attorney, no, let me do it. He thought God would help him during this period. So Bryan goes on the stand, and in one of the great scenes in the movie, Darrow asked him, well, when did creation take place? Well, 4004 B.C. And he said, well, when? On October 23 at 9 a.m. And Darrow says, was that Eastern Standard Time or Mountain Time? And of course, you know, it's funny. Except it doesn't come close to the truth. Remember I said that the leaders of the anti-evolution movement were willing to accept the antiquity of life on Earth. And the transcripts of the trial had been available in print since the end of 1925. So any historian worth his or her salt could have read this. When Darrow challenges Bryan, Bryan gets frustrated. I mean, clearly Darrow thought he was going to try to put everything in 6,000 years. Bryan says, we don't care whether the creation week was 6 days, 6 years, 6 million years, or 600 million years. That's not at stake in our debates. It was, of course, human evolution. But as the story goes, everybody in the courtroom was so shocked. Well, if they were knowledgeable at all, that wouldn't have surprised them. William Jennings Bryan had been endorsing the day-age interpretation of Genesis for as long as he had been talking about creation and evolution. On the eve of the Scopes trial, Bryan wrote to a number of people engaged in anti-evolutionism, inviting them to come down as experts for him. He didn't do too well. He wrote a Catholic journalist who had published a book called God or Gorilla, but name was McCann, wrote back and laid Bryan out for trying to shut up the people. He was especially annoyed because Bryan had been a big promoter of prohibition, and he hated that aspect. A prominent, maybe one of the most prominent evangelical scientists was an obstetrician and gynecologist at Johns Hopkins, one of the big four, Dr. Howard Kelly, who sometimes called himself a fundamentalist. And so Bryan wrote him and said, Dr. Kelly, I'd like for you to come down to Dayton, Tennessee and assist with the prosecution. And Dr. Kelly wrote back a very pleasant letter saying, "Well, Mr. Bryan, I really applaud the good work you've been doing, but I don't think I'd be an effective witness because I'm willing to accept organic evolution up to humans." Brian wrote back and said, "Dr. Kelly, I wouldn't like you to circulate this, but I agree with you. I think evolution is silly. I don't think the biologists have demonstrated what they've claimed, but I have no theological objections to evolution before the appearance of humans." I'm trying to do. How long do I have? Okay, I got to tell you an anecdote. It's one of my favorite ones, but it's not about price, really. As I say, Brian thought evolution was really pretty silly and used to go around the country giving a lecture, "The Menace of Darwinism," in which he would illustrate the failures of the evolutionists. And one of his best lines was to point out that these biologists, usually godless biologists, said that an ancient animal developed a mole and then noticed that over time it became sensitive to the light and would turn to maximize the amount of light because it felt really good. After a while, many years, millions of years perhaps, it became optically sensitive and turned into the vertebrate eye. And the punchline was, "And can you believe that it happened not once but twice?" You know, and it is. You got to wonder about that if you're worried. Because the eye had been used as an example of divine design for so long. This was probably the paradigmatic example that you would give. And so that was Brian. Twice in his cross-examination by Darrell, Darrell asked Brian, he said, "So are there any other authorities who would agree with you?" And he said, "Yes, two, George Frederick Wright and George McCready Price." Well, George Frederick Wright had been dead for 4 years. They probably would have agreed on most things. Price had been invited but was in England and couldn't come as an expert witness, and had only advised Brian, "By all means, stay away from the scientific issues. In effect, you're not qualified to handle that." Later in some memoirs, Price completely flipped and said that he had urged Brian to go and defend young earth creationism, which was faulty memory, let's say charitably. At which time, during the trial, Darrell says scoffingly, "Price is nothing but a mountebank and a charlatan. You know, he's not a reputable scientist to cite." So Price's reputation wasn't improved so much during that period. Now, Price did offer an alternative to the prevailing views of the day-age and gap. Drawing on the authority of Ellen White, he argued that the world that life on Earth was only about 6,000 or 7,000 years old, and that the entire geological column had been deposited during the 1 year of Noah's flood. For Price, the primary evidence for evolution came from geology, which provided the time and the development that evolutionists used. And he used to say, geology provides 90% of the evidence. And he probably devoted 90% of his writings to geology, one book to biology, The Phantom of Evolution. So one of the amazing things was that although Price became extremely popular in the 1920s, not a single other writer, anti-evolutionist, accepted his young earth creationism until about 1929, and then it was a marginal non-Adventist. Adventists already believed this on the authority of Ellen White, and they were making jokes about him that, you know, here was this layman out there fighting a war against who knows. So he got no respect except from fellow anti-evolutionists. In 1954, a sort of centrist evangelical theologian and philosopher named Bernard Ram wrote a book called The Scriptural View of Science. Christian View of Science and Scripture, excuse me. In which he argued that Price's interpretation of Genesis had come to form the backbone of fundamentalist opposition to evolution. And he termed this hyper-orthodoxy and really ridiculed it and urged evangelical Christians to return to the day, age, and gap theories or some other alternative that would allow them to accept as much of science as possible. Well, he exaggerated the influence of Price at that time. He also had a paradoxical effect. Instead of providing an epitaph for Price's views, he prompted a spirited response. A young Princeton-educated biblical scholar at Grace Theological Seminary in Indiana was so irritated by this attack that he decided he would write his doctoral dissertation as a defense of Price and an attack on Ram. He finished the dissertation, talked to some publishers, and they said, you don't have any scientific credentials. You need to buddy up with somebody who knows the science. And after some checking around with various people, he found one, a recently minted PhD from the University of Minnesota named Henry Morris, who had become a follower of Price's and had obtained his degree in hydraulic engineering, a PhD. So together, they wrote the book, The Genesis Flood, which came out in 1961. Now, they both were defenders of Price, but both of them were embarrassed by it. So at times, John Whitcomb, the co-author, graciously gave me access to all of his correspondence with Morris so I can kind of trace things week by week between the two of them. And on occasion, Morris would tell Whitcomb, you're following Price too closely and crediting him too much. People will make fun of us if all we're doing is recycling Price's views. And so Whitcomb would kind of relegate Price's influence to a footnote. And then Whitcomb would pay Morris back. Morris would be writing something, and he said, Henry, we've got to tone down this tribute to George McCready Price. And so Price slips a little bit into the background, although if you know anything about his views, they're front and center in the book, and critics saw it immediately when reviews started to appear. They sent a copy to the very ancient George McCready Price. He was in his 90s by this time. He was an irascible old guy, but seemed happy that somebody had taken up his cause. 3 years, 2 years after the publication of the Genesis Flood, which created a sensation in evangelical circles, a group of young earth, largely young earth creationists, formed the Creation Research Society, dedicated not to anti-evolutionism, but to Pricean flood geology. In about 1970, the advocates of this view decided, for political reasons, that they would rechristen this view, do away with flood geology, and call it creation science or scientific creationism. This interpretation of Genesis, which had been a tiny minority position among anti-evolutionists in the 1920s, almost entirely limited to the small Seventh-day Adventist community, became by the 1970s the very definition of creationism. If one said he or she were creationist in the middle 1970s, friend and foe alike would have assumed that that person was a young earth creationist. And perhaps I should end right there and let you ask any questions you would like to. Thank you very much.